Afro-descendants, from rural communities, what we call the other Colombia, that it really is have the hope to be integrated. And also many children and youth see now again as their role model to show that the only limit that they have is the sky, and they will face obstacles, but it is possible. He made this possible, and the entire Colombia is celebrating. And this is a moment of pride for Colombia and for the entire Latin American region. So we are really very happy and still celebrating.
Well, Luis Alberto Murillo, we thank you so much for being with us twice, Governor, also former Minister of Environment and Sustainable Development in Colombia, former Governor of the predominantly Afro-Colombian Department of Choco. And that does it for our show. He was outside the Colombian Ambassador to the United States House on Friday, along with so many others and thousands throughout Colombia protesting the murders of activists in Colombia. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
I cry now thinking of it.
The event Mickey's talking about happened over 70 years ago during World War II and still has the power to make him cry today. Every community across the United States has local folks like Mickey, veterans who have memories they carry with them for the rest of their lives. You can listen to Mickey recount his memories on Local Folks Podcast at KBOO.FM. Go to audio, list of programs, podcasts, web only, and click on Local Folks.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, another couple of mass shootings, one in New York and another in Gilroy, California, the garlic capital of the world.
Donald Trump threatens to declare Antifa as a terrorist organization.
And in Ethiopia, 350 million trees have been planted. So far this month, there have been a total of 44 mass shootings in the U.S., killing 37 people and wounding 188. That's an average of over 1.5 mass shootings per day.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 29th, 2019. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Ken Jones. A mass shooting on Sunday afternoon at the Gilroy Garlic Festival in California left 3 dead and 15 injured. Gilroy calls itself the garlic capital of the world. The dead include a 6-year-old boy and a 13-year-old girl. The suspect was identified as 19-year-old Santino William Legan. He was quickly shot and killed by the police. Witnesses report the shooter had a high-powered rifle and was shooting randomly at the crowd. The LA Times reports that Legan left social media posts referencing the novel Might is Right by Ragnar Redbeard, a right-wing book described as racist and misogynistic. The police found Legan's backpack that contained rifle ammunition. Meanwhile, there was another mass shooting in New York City on Saturday. At least one person died and another 11 were injured after a shooting at a popular block party in Brownsville, Brooklyn. The annual event draws people to the neighborhood from out of state for musical performances and other festivities. Police say they're looking for two suspects.
A suspicious package was found this morning near the entrance to the Deschutes County Courthouse. After 11 a.m., investigators released a photo of a man who is a person of interest in the case. The Oregon State Police Explosives Unit arrived shortly after the package was discovered. District Attorney John Hummel said the threat was to the courthouse and not his office. Several surrounding streets and buildings were closed down. Detectives are still investigating the case.
The city of Portland is settling a lawsuit for $80,000 this week regarding the abuse of a former city employee. Adam Rawlins made allegations that he was subjected to extreme hazing for several months in 2016, according to the suit. Rawlins was the recipient of repeated verbal abuse and multiple physical assaults. In addition to being bound, isolated, and punched, incidents where an air compressor shot metal screws and wooden strips at him were noted. Photographs taken by coworkers also emerged showing Rollins bound by duct tape and zip ties, stranded in a city shed. Benjamin Rosenthal, Rollins' attorney, argues that hazing rituals are a long-standing practice within the Transportation Bureau. City officials are calling it an isolated incident, though a consultant hired by the city found, quote, a don't-snitch culture rampant within the maintenance operations of the Bureau earlier this year. The settlement is headed to the Portland City Council for approval this Wednesday. Neither Tracy Reeve, Portland's top attorney, nor Chris Warner, Portland's transportation director, have responded to inquiries regarding the outcome of the suit. The city's risk management division has said the city may be found liable. Rollins initially filed the lawsuit with state court on September 1, 2018, seeking $250,000. The case was later moved to federal court in pursuit of $660,000. Rollins resigned from his utility worker job earlier this year.
A proposed landlord charge will go to a vote this Wednesday at Portland City Council. The $60 fee would be applied to landlords per unit per year to help operate the city renters service department. The $3.9 million expected per year from the charge will fund the renter services office created by the mayor to handle landlord-tenant issues, enforce fair housing laws, run evictions payment option programs, and administer a rental registrations database. Exemptions to the charge would be federally guaranteed affordable rental units and landlords who earn under 60% of the national median household income. City commissioners supporting the charge say it will help provide accurate rental housing supply data and will aid in crafting better policy. Other West Coast cities that employ rental unit registries are Seattle, San Diego, and Gresham.
Downtown Portland's new lunch counter, Stone Soup, offers job training and life skills programs for those at risk of homelessness. The Northwest Broadway Restaurant and Catering Company provides service skills including bartending, front and back of the house operations, and general industry practices aimed at Portlanders facing the street. Stone Soup will also be offering job placement programs upon completion of their four-month training programs. After years traveling for humanitarian work, USAID Foreign Service Officer Ronit Kirshner-Girard and partner Craig Girard decided to settle in Portland and open Stone Soup. While attempting to address Portland's food service labor shortage, they also wanted to focus on community building and making an impact on those at risk's lives. Ronit Girard said, "We don't care where they've been, we're more worried about where they want to go. If we help one person find a job, that's a win." Partially inspired by Seattle's Fair Start program, participants will be referred to Stone Soup by social services like Central City Concern and Transition Projects. After completion of the 12-week curriculum, individuals will do a one-week externship with a partner restaurant or grocer. Emphasis on both casual and fine dining techniques will be employed, with a general overview on building skills to thrive within a culinary team.
Sad news late last week when deputies recovered the body of a man who drowned in the Columbia River near Kelly Point Park on Friday night. It's another swimmer who disappeared in the river off a different beach has still not been recovered. Each year when the weather gets hot, swimmers lose their lives in Oregon rivers. The police received a call from Kelly Point saying there was a male swimmer in distress and underwater. Police began to look for the man without success. The body of a 22-year-old man, Carlos Lara Escudero, was found later. Kelly Point Park has had numerous drownings. There were four reported in 2006 to 2017. It was temporarily closed after two drownings in 2016. Swimming at the park has not been permitted since then because of the unsafe conditions.
The Milepost Fire in southern Oregon started overnight and has so far engulfed more than 11,000 acres. Crews arrived to the largest fire in the Pacific Northwest. They're trying to stop the fire from different directions, focusing on Interstate 5. It's already threatened several neighboring communities and structures. The fire is near Canyonville, which is about 100 miles north of the California border. It grew by another 2,000 acres Saturday and early Sunday. More than 900 firefighters have been deployed. Authorities claim the fire started because of an illegal campfire. Residents should be prepared to evacuate.
And another fire started at a plastic recycling facility in St. Helens yesterday has spread to surrounding vegetation. However, no buildings were damaged and no one was injured. The recycling center contained plastic squares used for recycling, including soda and water bottles. The bins that hold plastic caught on fire, which sent massive clouds of black smoke into the air. Firefighters worked quickly to find the fire and end it, and St. Helens police assisted with traffic control to keep the public away from the smoke. The cause of the fire is still under investigation.
Oregon Republican Senator Brian Boquist of Dallas has filed a lawsuit against a Democratic leader and other legislative officials. The complaint was lodged last Friday in U.S. District Court. Boquist told Senate President Peter Courtney in a June 19th floor speech, quote, "If you send the state police to get me, hell is coming to visit you personally." He also told state police they should, quote, "be bachelors and be well-armed." The lawsuit alleges that decisions to require notice of his appearance in the legislative chambers and fines imposed earlier this month for not showing up to vote on the cap and trade bill violate his First Amendment right to assembly and his constitutional right to due process. Oregon's Republican senators walked out of the Capitol last month and went into hiding to prevent a vote on House Bill 2020, a bill aimed at reducing fossil fuel emissions. State troopers were ordered to round up the absentees, and fines of $500 per day were issued. Additionally, a legislative committee voted to require Boquist to provide 12-hour notice prior to reporting to the Capitol so additional security could be summoned. Boquist's lawsuit names Courtney and two other committee Democrats, Senator Floyd Prozanski and Senator James Manny, both of Eugene.
Oregon Senator Ron Wyden became something of a hero over the weekend. KBOO's Imara Moore has the story.
In Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, the U.S. Senator Ron Wyden helped a pregnant woman get the medical help she needed, saving her life. Prior to this event, Wyden led a group of Oregon border justice advocates to El Paso, Texas, in New Mexico to investigate the conditions for migrants. They also visited El Ciudad Juarez in Mexico to understand the impact of Trump's policies. Wyden traveled with pediatrician Dr. Lauren Herber and many other important people. They visited the Paso del Norte port of entry and toured the holding cells and detention facility.
Ron Wyden here. I'm in El Paso at the port of entry with Dr. Herber, a wonderful advocate for kids in Springfield, Oregon. We just saw kids detained in cells. They shouldn't be there at all. I'm going to let Dr. Herbert tell you about it.
The cells that we did see, there were about 20 or 30 people per room, or it was more like 20 people per room.
That's right.
Where there were a mixture of children and adults, pretty packed in there, and there were no toys or anything for the children to play with. So that was disturbing to me that those kids had been there for 48 to 72 hours.
At the end of their trip, the group visited the shelter that houses asylum seekers. Wyden spoke with different families who told their story.
I had a chance with our translators to speak to two of them, and clearly they had lost all hope that America would help them in the face of persecution. And they made it clear that ICE and the private contractor simply were not effective in communicating to them about their rights. I spoke to one man who said that he couldn't read or write, he didn't know how to get in touch with a lawyer, and he made it clear that he would rather not live another day than to stay in this facility. And I'll just tell Oregonians and folks who are following our trip that what I saw is a textbook case for why you ought to end the cruel detention of individuals who simply represent no threat to the United States and have fled persecution.
Wyden met with one family who wants to remain unknown and learn their unique story. They wanted to seek asylum because they feared violence in Ciudad Juarez from drug cartels and government allies. The woman was also 38 weeks pregnant and suffered from preeclampsia, a potentially deadly condition.
Ron Wyden here. I've just left Juarez, and my last stop was particularly important. The folks there, they're being kept under the Remain in Mexico program, and they had never had a chance to speak to someone like a United States senator. and there I met a woman who was 8.5 months pregnant. Because I had a wonderful physician from Oregon, Dr. Herbert, with me, she said that the woman was looking at some very serious healthcare problems, some complications that could be fatal to her and her child, and she needed medical care. So they immediately packed all their belongings up. We headed for the border to make sure that she could get in the United States and get the medical care she needed.
The woman's complications were endangering her life and the unborn child. Therefore, the senator took the woman, husband, and son to the entry to make their asylum claim so they could get her some medical attention. The family and Wyden went to two custom officers and showed them their identification. They requested asylum, yet they were told by immigration officers that, quote, things were filled up. Once Wyden stepped forward, the officers changed how they acted.
All filled up and no way that she could get in. Then when they found out that I was the United States Senator, that we had a pediatrician with us, they changed their tune. Now that individual is going to be able to get the medical care that she so desperately needs.
He told the officers that Mexicans are exempt from the metering program. Metering is a way the CBP controls the number of people allowed to apply for asylum. The officers called an official who allowed the family to make their asylum claim. Ron Wyden shares how if he wasn't a member of Congress, the family would have been turned away and the mother-to-be may have likely died. For KBOO Evening News, this is Imara Moore.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO's News in Depth. Tonight we have a live in-studio interview with Elise Schumach, owner of Portland's Rose City Book Pub. We'll also be reporting on the protests at Mauna Kea in Hawaii over plans to build a new telescope on the site. At 6 on KBOO, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And the question is, what is trauma-informed yoga and why do we need it in our prisons? Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, increasing clouds with a low around 60. Tuesday, mostly cloudy, then gradually becoming sunny with a high near 82. Today in history, the year was 587 BC. The Neo-Babylonian Empire sacks Jerusalem and destroys the first temple. In 1921, Adolf Hitler becomes leader of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. The quote of the day is from Hannah Arendt, who said, "The ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the convinced communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction and the distinction between true and false no longer exist."
And the news continues. In a tweet on Saturday, Donald Trump threatened to declare the anti-fascist movement Antifa a terrorist organization. The announcement follows Senators Ted Cruz and Bill Cassidy's resolution earlier this month that called for its listing as a domestic terrorist organization. Trump called Antifa a group of, quote, gutless, radical left whack jobs who go around hitting non-fighters over the head with baseball bats. However, a report by the Anti-Defamation League found zero killings in 2018 tied to left-wing extremism, and that extremist-related murders were, quote, overwhelmingly linked to right-wing extremists. Antifa has received attention in recent weeks after conservative media pundit Andy Ngo was assaulted by counter-protesters at a march held by the alt-right group the Proud Boys in Portland. Trump's call triggered media users in Germany to push back against the remarks, tweeting #IAmAntifa. The hashtag trended on Twitter, sparking politicians to join as well. Bernd Rexinger, the co-chair of Germany's left party, tweeted, quote, "I am Antifa, always and everywhere. German history obliges us to stand up against racism and fascism. On the street and in parliament, hashtag never again."
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services says it will hold off putting unaccompanied migrant children at the former Japanese internment camp Fort Sill due to a decrease in unaccompanied children at the border. According to federal data, the number of people apprehended at the border fell 28% in June. It's believed that the downturn is largely due to conditions relating to the summer heat. Native American and Japanese American groups have protested the Trump administration's plan to house up to 1,400 migrant children at Fort Sill outside of the Oklahoma facility for more than a month. Fort Sill was used in 2014 to temporarily house more than 1,000 migrant children under the Obama administration.
Ongoing protests in Hong Kong have received condemnation from the national government today. Hong Kong Affairs Office spokesman Yang Gaeng commented on the protest at a press conference today, saying, quote, "No civilization or society under the rule of law would ever allow acts of violence to take place. We call on the general public of Hong Kong to be aware of the grave nature of the current situation." This was the first time that China's Hong Kong Policy Office had commented on the protests, which began in early June over a controversial bill that would have weakened much of Hong Kong's sovereignty. As a former British colony, Hong Kong has its own legal and judicial systems, and in the past was promised a high degree of autonomy from the Chinese government, except in foreign and defense affairs. Since June, the protesters' demands have expanded to encompass an investigation into police brutality and the resignation of Hong Kong leader Chief Executive Carrie Lam. Protesters and citizens alike found the conference less than satisfactory, with one telling CNN, quote, "As an agency with the power to dismiss Carrie Lam, it did not call for her to step down, so the press conference wasted 40 minutes of Hong Kong citizens' time." The forecast includes heavy showers of tear gas and rubber bullets, but only a slim chance for the removal of Carrie Lam.
More than 65 people taking part in a funeral procession in northeast Nigeria were attacked and killed on Saturday by a group of armed men. According to Nigerian state media, it's widely suspected the perpetrators were Boko Haram militants. The country's leaders have vowed to track down the attackers. The jihadist group has inhabited northern Nigerian states for the past decade, leading to the deaths of tens of thousands of people and the displacement of 2.4 million others. Local government officials say the group had previously attacked the Badu village community, but the residents fought back. The most recent attack appears to be a reprisal mission.
Beginning at 7 this morning in Altamira, Brazil, rival gangs started a riot in a small, overcrowded prison. Violence is not uncommon in Brazilian prisons, and the 52 dead are merely a footnote in the broken local prison system. While 16 people being decapitated and 36 suffocating to death in a resulting fire is horrific, Brazilian politicians do not seem to view it as a priority. Today's events are not the first. About 150 people were killed in January of 2017. Brazil's far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, has promised to crack down on gang violence and increase prison infrastructure, but so far it does not appear to be happening. Today's events took place in a prison with a maximum capacity of 200. More than 300 inmates were living there, and now a sixth of them are dead.
Klebsiella pneumoniae are bugs that are extremely drug-resistant. Many people are dying after contracting the infection. In 2007, over 300 deaths were because of the bugs, and it increased to 2,000 in 2015. The bacteria is found in human intestines, but if the bacteria spreads to the bloodstream or respiratory system, it can make infections untreatable. Infants, the elderly, and people with weak immune systems are at greater risks. Scientists have found that the bugs, quote, chew up the antibiotics and make them useless. They're transmitted through hospitals. Across Europe, they found the bugs in 244 hospitals. To decrease the chance of infections, hospitals need to keep good hygiene that includes early identification of the infection.
Some good news on the environmental front today. Ethiopia has planted more than 350 million trees in a day. That breaks the tree planting record in an attempt to tackle climate change and deforestation. The project is a part of Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's Green Legacy Initiative that calls for planting a total of 4 billion indigenous trees in over 1,000 sites across the country.
On Saturday, the New York Times reported that dozens of heavily armed illegal gold miners, dressed as military officials, invaded a remote indigenous village and murdered Wayapi chief Emira Wayapi. The attack on the village in Amapá State in Brazil is just one of a slew of invasions and assaults on indigenous territories by illegal miners, ranchers, and loggers. These invasions have increased by 150% since Brazil's right-wing president Jair Bolsonaro took office earlier this year, according to an indigenous rights and Amazon Protections NGO. Bolsonaro has vowed to open commercial mining on indigenous lands, which have been protected by Brazil's constitution since 1988.
Two teenage American tourists were arrested over the weekend and accused of aggravated murder and attempted extortion in the fatal stabbing of an Italian policeman. The fallen officer, Mario Cicciello Raga, was stabbed 11 times with a knife that matches what authorities believe the teenagers brought into Italy from the United States. The suspects have been identified as 19-year-old Finnegan Lee Elder and 18-year-old Christian Natale North. The officer was killed after attempting to recover a backpack that the two men were accused of stealing earlier that day after a botched drug deal. Both suspects have confessed to taking part in the crime, but have turned on one another and gave conflicting statements. Italian police can legally hold suspects for up to an entire year without official charges.
In 2017, monitoring stations around Europe detected a large release of nuclear waste. And we have finally found out why. KBOO's Ethan Fry has the story.
What is the cost of lies? It's not that we'll mistake them for the truth. The real danger is that if we hear enough lies, then we no longer recognize the truth at all.
These opening lines from the hit HBO miniseries Chernobyl highlight one key narrative which shines above the rest: the cost of lies. However, it seems that the modern-day Russian government didn't quite get the memo. In early October 2017, monitoring stations around Europe detected a large release of radioactive material, which was attributed to an unknown large nuclear accident of some sort. A new study published on Friday, authored by over 70 experts around the world, has located the cause of the leak: the Russian Mayak nuclear facility, something that Russia denies. This is the second disaster to occur at the Mayak facility, after the Kyshtym disaster of 1957, which was the second worst leak in history. Russian officials pinned the 2017 leak on a satellite re-entry, but over 1,000 measurements from monitoring stations in 30 countries say otherwise. More damning, however, is that no satellite went missing at that time. George Steinhauser, a co-author of the study, said that Russia's refusal to take responsibility for the nuclear release remains problematic, even if nobody was harmed. Scientists rely on rapid evidence gathering after such an event to help make plans that could prevent a similar occurrence elsewhere. Refusal to inform the scientific community or even acknowledge what happened is extremely dangerous. Nuclear accidents, no matter how small, must be reported given the potential consequences. Sadly, it appears that Russia has learned little about the cost of lies. For KBOO News, this is Ethan Fry.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 29th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ethan Fry, Imara Moore, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Jim Thompson, and our engineer is Daniel Parks. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Ken Jones.
We've got In Depth next. Have a great night, everyone.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Protesters are in their third week of occupying and blocking an access road that would allow workers to begin construction on a 30-meter telescope on the summit of Mauna Kea, a volcano that is sacred to Native Hawaiians. KBOO's Mackenzie Beard spoke with KBOO journalist Christopher Francisco live from the camp on Mauna Kea about the protest.
The Hawaiian business people here are protecting their mountain, Mauna Kea, and trying to build a telescope up here. And that's a sacred mountain to the people here. They built a blockade to keep the corporation that's going in there to build a telescope. They're blocking them right now. The elders are, along with the youth. And I think last week, I wasn't here. I just got here about 4 days ago. But last week, I guess they arrested about 30 elders. And I think they bailed them out already, and they're back over here. And yesterday, there was a large crowd. Weekends are pretty packed. You know, a lot of people come out. The local people come out here because everybody has jobs. And so the ones that are able to come out, they come out here and they support for about a couple of days. They rotate around, you know. People come in and out. There's a kind of a large encampment now. There's a lot of people here. I think they're closed down to one of the hills close by us because Forest Department, I think they're going to go in there and take a look around and make sure it's clean and stuff like that. So, and then on the other side of the road, the blockade, is the law enforcement. So they're over on the other side, and we don't know when they're coming in. People say it could be any time, but the spirits are high. They're not giving up because it's a sacred place, and, you know, I could feel it too. We have prayer 3 times a day, morning, afternoon, and evening ceremonies. A lot of people come in, indigenous people come in, and they teach the Hawaiian language, dance, and history. And so you could work in the kitchen or security. Well, there's no security, they call them. Protectors, you know, there's a difference between the security, and they're just there to provide protection in case the law enforcement come in. And pretty much just, you know, camp life, taking care of yourself.
So since you've arrived, who's the most involved in setting up these protests, and who are the main people there?
I got started was like the elders and the local people here from around the islands and stuff. They said it's been going on for 2014 or something like that. I haven't really gotten the real history behind that, except for what I hear other people saying, is that they started from there and they built the roadblock, and they were up on top of the Mauna Kea, which is really, really high elevation, and I guess it's kind of harder to have a camp up there, and getting back and forth is really hard. So they brought it down here closer to the road. Blockade is right here, and it's mostly like the local people, the indigenous people of this area. And they have their own media, they have their own security, they have their own, the royal family or something like that of indigenous people. And they stand out here too in support of the people, of the cause.
Around how many people would you say are at the camp?
They said it started with 30 people and then it went up to like 2,000. Yesterday was a lot of people. Weekends it's packed, about 2,000 people. And right now we're back down, weekdays back down to a very few numbers. I don't know, about like 500 or something like that.
So it's definitely grown then. So what is the state of the camp, and, you know, what are some of the problems you guys are facing there?
It's really wet, really cold in the evenings and in the morning. And sometimes in the afternoon, if it rains, you know, it's always wet. It's misty all the time. You know, it's always, like, wet around here most of the time. And we're in a higher elevation. Yesterday, I went into Hilo, Hawaii. It's down to Hilo, they call it. I went down there, and it was really cold up here. But when I got down there, it was really hot. I had to take off all my layers. And I had to go purchase a Verizon phone because the T-Mobile doesn't work up here. They're very well organized. They really got it together, man. I mean, they have a lot of support from their own people. You know, they come up here and they bring supplies, and pretty much you just have to, like, get rain gear and, you know, just keep yourself dry. And the foods, cook their own traditional foods and stuff. People bring them, and they feed the camp, and that they have porta potties, and pretty much we're just policing our own selves. You know, we're not, law enforcement tried to say that they're the ones that are keeping us in check, but pretty much they have their own, these guys they call protectors, going around and making sure, you know, that, you know, everybody's safe and stuff like that. It's pretty much just the people, you know, the local people. There's not a whole lot of white people or, you know, other nationalities. It's just like mostly their people that are here running the things, because that's what they want. They want their own people to be empowered. That's why they do it. And they have their own people teaching too, pretty much well organized.
Since you've arrived and since you've been having conversations with people, how have they said that local officials and politicians have responded to the camp and the protests over the telescope?
I haven't really heard much about around here about the officials. I think in the beginning, the first week, I think they came in, you know, the cops came in and they arrested 30 people. They were bailed out. It's pretty much now is just like empowering the people and decolonizing the minds and teaching the young kids and the language. And also what they really stress is tourism, you know, like, the, you know, tourism isn't a, Aloha isn't about, it's more commercialized, you know, capitalism, trying to do away with all that and then go back to originally who they are, you know, like their language has been, you know, used for commercializing and capitalism, and the land is being commercialized. Who is it for? It's not for them. It's their land, and who's making all this money? It's not them. They really want their land back. They want their people to be able to survive the way they used to survive and the way, you know, the matriarch society, and they want, you know, the same thing Native people, similar to Native people, Indigenous people in the United States. And so I don't hear too much about the other side, what they're doing. It's pretty much empowering themselves, and I'm just learning a lot from, you know, the last couple of days at the university, just figuring out what's going on.
Can you talk a little bit about the state of Indigenous protections and protests in the United States as well, in conjunction with what's happening in Hawaii?
I think people are rising all over. They say the seventh generation is going to rise up, and they'll come a rainbow tribe, diverse of people from all walks of life, like-minded people that care for the water, for the air, for the fire, for Mother Earth, Father Sky, for each other. If we will unite together, you know, that we save this planet for our future generations. And it's pretty much, that's the Indigenous struggle, because the patriarch society, they want to destroy the land, build telescope, or drill uranium mining, coal mining. I mean, Donald Trump, everybody knows that, you know, he's trying to take more Indigenous land, and so he can privatize it for corporations to come and mine these places so that he can create jobs, as he says, you know. And it's pretty much just all of us Indigenous people just sharing our knowledge and our similarities with each other, and empowering each other, and going home and sharing our stories with each other, and to let each other know that we're not alone, that we're all going to be together, we're all going to unite, take our lands back, because that's where we're from. We come. Each Indigenous tribe has a creation story of where they came from, where we emerge into this land, and the universe has, you know, blessed us with this place to be caretakers. We're the patriots of this land. We're trying to tell the corporations that, you know, we need clean water and clean air. You know, we're not here trying to destroy it. But then we have our sellouts, you know, like people that, if you oppress people, you know, you take their land, language, and all the resources, and you oppress them so much that you're going to have, like, people that will agree with you. And those are the ones that usually go to, is the one that agree with them. And sometimes they're bought off, or they're, you know, favoritism, and, you know, they're... And then you have, on the other side, you have, like, Indigenous people that just want the land back so they can live on it, and their future generations can live on it. And basically here is they're really saying that. They say, we want Hawaii back. And all it is a commercial place for people to come and party and do all these things, and just disrespect their language and disrespect their ways of life, and commercializing it, taking it out of context, away from the spiritual meaning of what the Aloha and Pono, really just colonizing it for capitalism. They're trying to let people know about that, trying to say that we don't want to be a part of that system.
Can you talk about some of the similarities and differences between the protests and camps at Mauna Kea and other indigenous efforts like what happened at Standing Rock?
It's pretty much like the same. The similarities, indigenous elders came out, they're in prayer, uniting together for a cause, and they're basically just the same thing all over. It's not just recently. The same thing that's been going on for 500 years. You know, people, all our ancestors that were fighting hard against the pilgrims. You know, when the pilgrims first came here, you know, we fed them, we took care of them because we had these things called values and morals. And they didn't want another human to die, so they taught them how to live on this land. And for that, you know, they got destroyed. Their ways of life got destroyed. So it's been going on. I mean, nothing has really changed. It's been going on since then. People are still trying to fight for their ways of life. The colonization is still spreading to other countries, Africa, you know, Iraq, in the name of democracy. Democracy really came from the Mohawk, the Confederacy, the Onondagan people, the law of peace. But Jefferson, they just took the parts that they would use. They didn't use all the law of peace because that's true democracy. They only took out what they wanted. And that's how this organization called America, this corporation called America, got started.
So how can our listeners get involved then to help support their efforts?
There's a website you can go to. They have their own website here. I mean, I can't pronounce it. I don't want to say it. Type in Protect Mauna Kea or Mauna Kea Protectors. Their information is all online, and you just figure it out. Do your own research, you know, your homework.
If you had a final message for our listeners, what would it be?
Just look deep within your own self and, you know, do your own homework and decolonize your mind and just recognize whose land you're on and appreciate the people and just love one another and unite together and take down this patriarch system, dismantle it, and give the land back to indigenous people. And basically, that's really what they're saying here. They're really strong about that.
For KBOO News, I'm Mackenzie Beard.
You're listening to KBOO's News in Depth. You'd figure that bringing together books and beer would be a slam dunk, especially in Portland, but we didn't get our first official bookstore / bar until November of last year. The Rose City Book Pub, located on Northeast Fremont, is a godsend for those of us who love to read and drink, often at the same time, and enjoy doing it in the company of like-minded folks. In addition to a collection of used books and a tap list heavy on Northwest beers, Rose City Book Pub serves food, wine, and cocktails, and hosts regular events such as readings, live music, book clubs, fundraisers, and study groups. To find out more, we're fortunate to have Elise Schumach, the owner of Rose City Book Pub, live with us now in the newsroom. Elise, thanks so much for coming into KBOO today.
Thanks for having me.
Elise, first I should tell listeners that you're no stranger to KBOO. In fact, your dad, Jim Schumach, was a longtime KBOO on-air personality hosting our Between the Cover show, a weekly program featuring interviews with authors. That must have been an influence on you growing up, right? As a budding reader yourself.
Yeah. We were a family of readers. And then my dad did the recordings at our house.
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I'm not in the studio here.
Yeah, and then
the writers then came to your house and he recorded them there.
Oh. And there are quite a few authors who will tell you about this funky experience of going into the basement studio past the washer and dryer. And
of course, that looks a lot like KBOO except for the washer and dryer. So let's get to your own creation here, the Rose City Book Pub, and I'll start with a Yelp review. Quote, "This place is pretty awesome. Do you ever have a book and want to read? Do you ever want to read with beer and or wine, maybe a cocktail? Not a bar, not some scene place, but some place where you can actually read. I've long wanted one, and this is it." Was that something that you were looking for too, and which inspired you to open up a book pub?
Yeah, I've always read at bars. I read anywhere, and I'm sort of a late night person, and I like to read surrounded by other people, and then I also don't mind being interrupted and then joining a conversation and kind of having the night flow from some time to yourself to time with the community.
And that was actually one of the events leading up to the book pub. You were reading, was it the Harper's Magazine?
Yeah, at a total divey sports bar where that's not done there.
And what's the story?
So my friend, the person I ended up being friends with came up to me and he's like, "Are you reading Harper's?"
in a total divey bar.
And then it ended up being his idea actually to open the book pub. But he didn't have the means to make that happen. And I was looking for an escape to get back to Portland from a long exile in Los Angeles.
Teaching Latin there, huh?
Yeah. And then he ended up working for me for a few months, but we've sent him off for a better job at Metro.
So he's in Portland now.
Yeah.
But he probably gets free beer, I would hope, when he shows up, coming up with the idea. Now, you've described the pub as putting all the things I like together in one room, which is wine and beer and books and people. So how'd you go from that blueprint to making the pub a reality?
I set the plan out a few years in advance. I needed to disentangle graciously from some obligations in Los Angeles. So in 2015, I said I would end my time there at the end of 2018 school year. And then I moved back home. I got a great broker who started poking around and gave him my list of wants and needs. And then something emerged pretty close to where I grew up.
Just amazing. You really scored because I read some initial interviews before the pub opened, and you were searching for places way out, 72nd, 82nd Avenue. Here you got something on 13th and Northeast Fremont.
Right. My hope was to be somewhat central because I knew that wherever I was, there would be a locals draw, but that what I was offering is something that should have a citywide draw. And so I didn't want to be too far out to the edges.
We should tell people that what you eventually did find was an Irish pub that had been there for a while and then was in the process of closing down.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you do to turn that into the book pub? You left some things the same and then added bookshelves, things like that?
I left quite a bit. They had these wonderful pews from when it was a storefront church 20 years ago. And so they had those and the wood kind of mismatched antique-y kind of look goes well for me. And then I added...
Oh, so it went from a church to an Irish pub to a book pub.
Yep. Wow. And so I added bookcases and I added some soft furniture. And then I took the darts away and made that into a reading cubby. Yeah.
You don't want to give a reader darts. Dangerous.
Book darts.
Now, you were able to get most of the needed funding through online crowdsourcing. I saw you had an Indiegogo campaign.
Yeah.
You raised close to $11,000 to help open up the pub.
That was not the majority of the funding. That's a pretty small part. But a lot of why I did that was for advanced publicity, to let people know that this was coming. But I did make about $11,000 from that, and then I got an SBA loan, and then I sold my condo.
Because it cost more than $11,000 to keep things going. Now, for the bookstore part of Rose City Book Pub, you stock what's described on the website as a curated collection of good books, mostly used, I think, right?
Used except for authors who've read there recently or who are about to read there, local authors, local presses.
You'll have new books there for people to buy and get signed.
But that's a really small part of our collection, and then it is mostly used books.
Now, what do you look for in deciding which titles to offer? Where's the curation come in?
I think, my focus is literary fiction and then popular nonfiction. And I do like nice volumes, where it's a nice artifact as well. But then we also have quite a few of pretty banged up old paperbacks. I am a little bit snobby when it comes to fiction. I'm not as snobby when it comes to nonfiction. So I don't carry much in the way of romance and mystery and things like that.
My wife's into a Louise Penny kick right now. She's a Quebec mystery writer, but you wouldn't carry Louise Penny then.
I mean, if one or two came my way, but there are other bookstores that are serving that purpose, and I think ours.
Could you name a few of your favorite literary fiction writers?
Let's see. I always like Willa Cather. And then I have really enjoyed Knausgård lately.
And he just published volume 6 of his My Struggle.
And let's see, I go back a lot to Jane Austen always, and
now what about books from your dad's collection? You've got some of those there too, and some of those are actually signed by the authors who came to your house and passed by the washing machine and the dryer.
We've pulled out the ones that say "Dear Jim," but the ones that are just a signature are all available for sale. The ones that are higher value, I aren't at the store, and I'm going to put them up online sometime.
Like an eBay type thing.
Yeah.
Because the volumes are worth a little bit more.
Right.
Signed by that author, and some of them might not be around anymore, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, perhaps just as important as the books is the beer. Is it a rotating tap list, and what's the curation process like for the drinks?
Yeah, we have, I have 18 taps, and 2 of those are nitro, and we... the only one that stays on is Olympia, and then other than that, it's mostly Northwest beers. Every once in a while, there will be something really special, like Sculpin.
San Diego.
Point. Yeah, and then we do a lot with Matchless and North Jetty and Second Profession.
So there's really for a beer aficionado, this is the place to go. They're not going to be disappointed.
Yeah, and
there's
it's
plenty of choices.
Yeah, and we try and keep, you know, there's always a few IPAs, and these days one of those will be a brut or a hazy, and then there should be a red and a pilsner, and in the summertime you want a few more of the light ones like a Kolsch. Right now I know we have a saison and I have a really sour from Culmination.
that's trendy.
Yeah.
The sour beers.
Oh, the sours are great. I always have a few ciders, and I try and keep those on gluten-free lines, and I have Hum Kombucha.
It's a authentic Portland tap place, with the kombucha and the cider and the beers.
Yeah.
Now, one question that came up for me, because I do work sometimes in coffee shops, is how do you balance a reader's desire for a comfortable, somewhat quiet place to read with those who might be there for drinks and conversation?
There are sort of different zones in the pub, plus the patio. So if no one else is out on the patio, then that's the quiet place. And if everyone's on the patio, then it's the noisy place. And I have a few little cubbies. And then obviously if you're sitting at the bar itself, then you're signaling that you want it to be social. And then if it is noisy and someone is trying to read or do something very quiet, we have earplugs available for free at the bar.
Wow. And you don't play loud music then?
We play some music, but it's not loud. It's in the kitchen.
Now, a time when if you just want to read and have quiet, you probably wouldn't want to be there during one of the evening events, and you have quite a few of those. Can you talk about, we mentioned, or you were talking to me before the interview about some of the readings that you have there, and you actually have a reading there tonight, and you have live music, and you have trivia night, study groups. Can you talk about some of those?
So if someone wanted a particularly quiet space, a lot of times 7:30 to 9 is not your best bet, because we often have events then. And so this week is Tell Me a Story, which is a story series curated by Jessica Wadley. Tomorrow is jazz.
And that's about 4 or 5 writers come in to do readings. Mm-hmm. And that's at 7:30 tonight, by the way.
And then tomorrow from 7 to 10, we have the Jazz Open Jam. And that is hosted by Pablo Rivarola.
How does that work? Musicians just bring their instruments and they jam together?
Yeah. And so there's sort of a house band, and they start. And then I think that they just sort of, if you want to play, you just come up and let them know that you want to play. And then they find out if there's something you all know in common. And then I think some people bring their own instruments if it's smaller, but then I think the house band drummer shares his drums. and, you know, because that's too chaotic to
right.
and it's fantastic. It's mostly younger people, but we have had a few of the old guard come in and jam with the young folks. And these young people are incredibly talented.
Oh, we're blessed in Portland to have so many talented musicians. This is nice to have a venue for them.
Yeah. And then on Wednesday night at 7:30, we have trivia, and I'm the host for that.
And that's literary trivia mostly, right?
Well, no, it's 5 rounds of 10 questions each, and 1 round's always literary.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then if any minors come to play, then I make a point of ending by 9 o'clock. Because we do have sometimes families come or young folks who have a friend who's 20, something like that.
And at other times of the day, you actually have, after school, because it's called the after school homework groups, right?
Yeah.
So kids will come and study together, which I see a lot in coffee shops. So it's really good to have something like that for them there.
Yeah. And then honestly, we have quite a few people who, older students who come in at around midnight. I have one guy who's an anesthesiology resident.
Ah, and he studies?
And he comes in the middle of the night because he has crazy hours. And then this last week we've had a woman studying for the bar, which is tomorrow. And so she's come at some strange hours. And so, and we had a guest finish the last week and a half of his dissertation. He worked on it at our place and he came at some strange hours.
Now, you seem to be really enjoying meeting some of the people who come there.
Oh, I love that so much.
A very nice part of owning the book pub.
And the kind of people who want to be at my place are really, really lovely people. It's it really feels like a deep part of the community.
Which it leads to my next question. You have several programs there where you give back to the community. There's one in particular, Buy a Meal, Give a Meal. There's another one where you have a textbook fund. You donate 50 cents to a textbook scholarship. Can you talk about a few of those and why you do those?
Yeah, so I've always believed in being part of the community, and some of that is service. And
this is the community you grew up in, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. And I grew up really close to there, closer to Hollywood. And so the Buy a Meal, Give a Meal is the grilled cheese with super salad. And anytime someone buys that, we donate the cost of a meal to the Oregon Food Bank, which is only 33 cents. So, but it does add up. And we've donated, I think, 3,200 meals since we opened in November.
Oh, my.
And then the other one is a textbook scholarship for a graduating senior from Grant High School, which is my alma mater. And we were able to raise enough for one $500 scholarship this last year. And it, and I just last week I gave it to a young woman named Julie. And then I'm hoping, since I'll have closer to a full year to do it, I'm hoping to have 2 scholarships next year.
You've really progressed quickly, considering you've only been open for about 9 months now.
Yeah.
And the book club's become a very integral part of the community, especially the literary community here in Portland.
Yeah, I think there was a shortage of places for what I'm offering for the literary community. I think it's
well, there's no other book pub in the city,
right?
And there's very few in the country, apparently, right?
And it's hard to find the right venue for a reading. A lot of the bookstores here are pretty tiny and cozy, and then Powell's is big enough that you have to be pretty big to make it on their list. And then other bars are obviously not hosting a lot of book reading.
Yes, it wouldn't be a very friendly atmosphere for the writer, I don't think.
Right.
Now, do you have any future plans, Elise, that you can share with us for the book pub? Are pretty much things are going really well, and just continue with those for a while?
Yeah, I think I like what I'm doing. I'm hoping to expand more of the late night crowd, and I'd love to see more people there at lunchtime. But it's, I think it's become the thing I wanted it to be.
Now, can you tell our listeners how to find out more about the Rose City Book Pub, hours, menu, special events?
Yeah, the website's rosecitybookpub.com. The Instagram is Rose City Book Pub with underscores between the words. And Facebook, we're rosecitybookpub.com, or Rose City Book Pub. And the hours are 11 a.m. to 2 a.m. every day.
Yes, so there's plenty of time for everybody to get in there sometime.
Yeah.
Well, Elise, thanks so much for joining us at KBOO this afternoon.
Thank you, Ken.
We've been talking with Elise Schumach, owner and operator of Portland's Rose City Book Pub. The book pub is located at 1329 Northeast Fremont. And as Elise said, it's open every day from 11 a.m. to 2 in the morning. You can meet the anesthesiologist and the budding lawyer there at those hours, I think. And you can find out more on their website, rosecitybookpub.com, and on Facebook under Rose City Book Pub. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll screen Power of Community, How Cuba Survived Peak Oil on Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1990, Cuba's oil supply was cut by more than half. This film tells of the hardships and struggles, as well as the community and creativity of the Cuban people during this transition away from a highly mechanized agricultural system to one using organic methods of farming and local urban gardens. Again, that's How Cuba Survived Peak Oil, Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned, values-driven natural foods cooperative open daily from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a weekly farmer's market every Wednesday year-round. Located at Southeast Tibbetts Street and 21st Avenue in Portland for almost 50 years. Online at peoples.coop.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab.